Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday morning, the 2nd of March. Coming up in just a moment, our guest has written a very provocative piece on higher education. He says that the book that he has written is, which is titled The Marketplace of Ideas, Reform and Resistance in the American University, is an attempt to answer four questions. Why it's so hard to institute a general education curriculum? Why did the humanities disciplines undergo a crisis of legitimacy? Why has interdisciplinary become a magic word? And why do professors all tend to have the same politics? We'll talk about those issues with our guest, who has some very interesting things to say in just one moment. His name is Louis Menand. He is a professor of English at Harvard University, and he joins us momentarily. This is our Wisconsin Public Radio Winter Membership Drive. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Joining me in the studio is Rhonda Fanning, producer of this program. The goal is simple, to raise the funds needed to pay for the programs that you listen to. And because you value public radio, please also take care of public radio. You can do your part by contributing now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi, Kathleen. I just want to take a moment to thank everyone again for last hour to helping us get that $2,500 challenge grant from Bill Vanderson and Christina Gerke. But this is a new hour, and we have a new goal of 75 pledges, and we just got two in, so we have a goal left of 73 pledges, and meeting this goal ensures that Wisconsin Public Radio has the money we need to fund informative programs in the months to come. Give online at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 and help us meet this goal.
In just a minute, we'll be speaking, as I said, to Louis Menand, author of The Marketplace of Ideas, Reform and Resistance in the American University. He's also a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker, and he'll be with us to talk about higher education, the challenges that it faces right now. Discussions like this one on the Ideas Network are possible because of your financial support. We don't ask you for money very often, but we are now. Please give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And Kathleen, I wanted to mention that anyone who pledges this hour at that $150 level will get a copy of Louis Menand's book, The Marketplace of Ideas, Reform and Resistance in the American University. So this hour only a pledge of $150, and we'll be happy to send you a copy of Mr. Menand's book.
It's particularly interesting to people who have an interest, and I know that's many of you, in higher education. Those of you who are in higher education right now, you'll find it very challenging. We all support higher education through our tax dollars, or we have children we've sent to college, or we're going to send to college, or we've been to college ourselves. It really has some provocative questions, and I think you'll find it it started as four essays, and you'll find it thought-provoking, to say the least.
That's right. WPR.org or 888-202-2552. On the Ideas Network, you hear from the person who wrote the bill or who wrote the book, who has a unique expertise or compelling life story. And we are glad to seek these people out, and sometimes with your help, and get them on the show. Privileged, in fact. But we need your help to make it possible in the months to come. Make great radio happen right now with your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And just a reminder, for $150, we'll be very happy to send you a copy of The Marketplace of Ideas. We'll shortly be talking about that, and you'll find it a really compelling read. I also want to mention that when Rhonda talks about getting people on the show, she is so good. And Chrissy, who has just started with us, Rhonda has a stellar reputation among producers everywhere, I think, for getting not the same people all the time. She gets people who have been, if we're talking about Afghanistan, Peace Corps volunteers in Afghanistan who have worked in the country or frequently are in the country during the time that we're talking with them. She's not a librarian for nothing. Her skills really translate well into producing for this program. So I hope you appreciate her hard work and her creativity in making this, I think, a great show. So call and pledge, all right? It's WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Thank you, Kathleen.
You're
I'll be
welcome,
back with
Rhonda.
You in a little bit.
All right. And now we are moving into our conversation about, well, our guest says the book that he has written is an attempt to answer four questions about American higher education today, why it is so hard to institute a general education curriculum, how did the humanities disciplines undergo a crisis of legitimation, why has interdisciplinary become a magic word, and why do professors all tend to have the same politics? The American university, our guest says, is a product of the 19th century, and it has changed very little structurally since the time of the First World War. It has changed in other ways, but it's still a late 19th century system put into place for late 19th century reasons. What are those reasons? So should some of it stay relatively the same, or do changes need to be made? Louis Menand is our guest. He is the author of The Marketplace of Ideas, Reform and Resistance in the American University. He is a professor of English at Harvard University, also the author of The Metaphysical Club, which won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize in History, and he has been a staff writer for The New Yorker since 2001. We'll be welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number for you to call. Professor Louis Menand, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell me about your college experience. Where did you go? How did you decide where you were going? Were you happy with what you received?
Yeah, I had a great time in college. So I applied to four colleges. I only got into one. It was Pomona College.
Oh.
I lived on the East Coast. I'd never been to California in my life. And one day in September, I got on an airplane and flew to L.A., and I went to this place, and it was an incredible experience.
So you moved all the way across country. Were you scared?
Yeah, I was terrified. You know, this is in the days when, you know, you had to use a payphone to call your parents, collect, and all that kind of stuff. So
right.
It was really felt like I had gone to the moon. But I love California, and it's a great liberal arts college, very different from the world that I'd come from, and really happy that I did it.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the statistics you cite early in the book when you talk about liberal arts schools. Most of the institutions are not in this country liberal arts schools, and there aren't that many people graduating in the liberal arts field. What do you think of that? Why is that the case, and is that good, bad, indifferent?
I just think it's an ignored statistic. I think when most people who write about higher education and the kind of people who read the kind of books that I write think of college as filled with people who major in liberal arts subjects like history and English or physics or psychology. But in fact, of the four-year institutions in the United States, of which there are about 2,500, fewer than half of those actually are liberal arts schools that give most of their undergraduate degrees in the liberal arts. 22% of people who get bachelor's degrees in the United States major in business, and 2% major in history. So when we worry about what students are being taught in history courses and in English courses, we're really talking about a pretty small percentage of the overall population of college students. It's a mass education system that we have now. It's fantastic. So many people go to college in the United States, but they're getting very different kinds of education.
And what do you think about that? Is that a bad thing?
No, I think it's a good thing. It's just that it's a little, when we talk about higher education, we tend to focus on the relatively small slice of the pie that is four-year liberal arts colleges, with good reason, because that's, you know, that's the elite of American higher education that tends to produce the future leaders. But we're missing a lot of what's going on out there if we focus just on that sector. But it's a good thing in the sense that people are getting better educated for the professions that they go into. 10% of undergraduate degrees are in education. Those people become educators, teachers, principals, and so on. About 6 or 7% are in the health professions. Those are not liberal arts subjects, but it's certainly a great thing that we have this fantastic educational system to help people who want to have those careers.
If you are going to college and you're majoring in English or you're majoring in history, you're majoring in religious studies, political science, are the courses actually designed to train you to become a professor in those areas?
Yeah, that's the way the system works. So it's an oddity, because the idea behind the liberal arts experience, and this is something that was instituted in the late 19th century when there was a kind of split between professional education and vocational training and liberal arts education. So the idea behind the college experience, the liberal arts experience, is that it's not vocational. You're not being trained for a profession. But actually, you are, because if you major in English, you're basically being trained to be an English professor, which is a profession. So college students have this odd situation in which they are encouraged to seek knowledge for its own sake and not to worry about careers and not to think about what they're learning as proto-professional training. And yet, they also major in a subject, and the major is designed to help them, if they want to, go on to graduate school and become a professor in that field. So it's a little bit of a contradiction in the message that students get.
You write in the book about general education and about schools that have requirements, and when they started, of you need to learn this body of knowledge because it's going to find its way into almost everything you do during the course of your lifetime, and there's something good about society having a body of knowledge. Tell me how things are done when it comes to that issue at places like Harvard, at other schools in the country, when it was started in this country, and whether or not it's valuable or not to have a core basis of knowledge.
I think it really is valuable. It's just become very difficult to get faculty to reach a consensus about what those courses should consist of. General education started around the time of the First World War, and it was started because people felt at places like Columbia, that has one of the earliest, and Stanford had one of the earliest general education programs, that college students weren't learning enough that they needed to know to become citizens in the world after they graduated, and that just taking a course in political science or being a major in religious studies or something wasn't giving you enough information and enough knowledge and enough skills. So general education was a way of instituting courses that were not just courses in departments, but gave students a broad overview of the great books or the issues of contemporary civilization or whatever the faculty decided. And that has been a tradition in higher education. Harvard has something like that now. Columbia's had a very famous great books course, two couple great books courses that all students are required to take since the 1940s. Chicago has a similar program. A lot of schools use what's called a distribution requirement, which is just requiring students to take at least three courses in each of the three divisions. That is to say, three courses in science, three courses in social science, three courses in the humanities. It doesn't really matter what the courses are. Those courses tend to be departmental courses. That's one way of having general education requirements, and a lot of places do it because it's sort of a default mode. It doesn't require a lot of administrative overhead. But if you try to institute courses like Columbia's, which is a great books course, not a department course, every student has to take it. You have to staff it. You have to decide on the curriculum. It's a whole separate administrative department. But students who do that, and they often pick a college because they have courses like that, like a lot of people go to Columbia for that course, they really enjoy it, and they feel it's something they take away that they have in common with all of their fellow graduates. If you just major in physics, you don't have a lot in common with the English major, but if you've both taken this great books course, then you have something that you learn together.
And does it recast liberal education, as you talk about, with life goals in mind?
Yeah, general education, it's funny because we think about the great books as the opposite of thinking about education for life. But actually, almost all the great general education curricula, and there are a few exceptions like Chicago, were really designed because faculty were worried that students weren't learning things that would be useful to them in life, that as they weren't, when they specialize in an academic discipline and learn how to do anthropology, let's say, that might be very valuable, but they weren't learning the broader issues and methods and ethical questions that were important for everybody when they graduate. So general education is the public face of liberal education.
Then we run into the problem, and tell me how egos are involved here. Not that there would be any egos in higher education, but
really?
I suspect there might
Harvard.
Be a few. No, not at
Harvard.
We don't
have that problem.
No, I'm sure you don't. Not a bit. But if we're going to come up with some kind of curriculum, what does it consist of? Well, it darn well better include my course.
Yeah, one finds that when one has tried to work on devising a general education curriculum, that faculty all want a seat at the table. It's totally understandable. And they feel that, well, what we teach in my department, whatever it is, everybody should take a course in. It's just really important for life. And it's hard to disagree with that. And it does show that faculty believe that they're teaching what they teach because it matters. It makes a difference. People ought to learn something about it. But you can't get everybody at the table. Harvard has 44 departments. There's no way you could require students to take 44 courses or even bits of courses in all those departments. So you have to make decisions, and that's where people bump heads.
Mm-hmm. What about this idea? Let's explore it in more depth. You write, almost any liberal arts field can be made non-liberal by turning it in the direction of some practical skill with which it is already associated. Do we need more of that? English departments, you say, can become writing programs, even publishing programs. And then you also talk about, conversely, and more importantly, any practical field can be made liberal simply by teaching it historically or theoretically. So two questions here. One is, should it be that way? And two, is it at all, or is that something to move toward?
Well, I make those points to address what I think is kind of a superstition that people, college professors, have often, which is that there's some opposition between learning things that have practical value and learning disinterestedly. And my point is that we do learn disinterestedly in liberal arts schools. That's how we teach the subjects. We teach knowledge for its own sake. But all the subjects that we teach do have practical sides to them and practical applications to them. And it seems to me there's nothing wrong with recognizing that in the classroom and talking about the application that our subject might have to the world of work and the world outside the university. Conversely, a lot of what we teach in liberal arts education is theoretical or historical knowledge. We teach about the sort of backstory of current arrangements. That kind of knowledge, although it is disinterested, is also very useful for people who are ultimately going to be professionals in a particular field. I think I quote in the book this famous saying. It's been attributed to various people, but the saying is, garbage is garbage, but the history of garbage is scholarship. So if you teach the history of law or the history of medicine or the history of accounting or the history of business, you are teaching in a liberal arts spirit because that's what we do, a lot of what we do. But it's also useful for people in business, law, and medicine, and so forth, to know something about the history of their own fields. It empowers them. It gives them an idea of how change occurs and how change might occur in the future. So there's, I think, a real important synchronicity between what we do in liberal arts education and what people do in professional schools that tends to get ignored because there's a firewall between those two operations.
Mm-hmm. We welcome phone calls for you, and we'll take them momentarily. 800-488-6655 is the number. Our guest is Louis Menand. He is a professor of English at Harvard University and the author of The Marketplace of Ideas, Reform and Resistance in the American University. We'll be at your calls at 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Professor Menand. If you'd like to join us, 800-486-8655, starting our calls with Gary from Iron River. Hi, Gary.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
Hey, I've got an engineering degree back from the 70s, and it's in those days, of course, I guess still now, there's a number of liberal arts courses you have to take, which have proved, I think, very valuable in my career, both work and just in normal life. But listening nowadays to the complex debates in society, whether it's global warming or nuclear power or healthcare or whatever, it seems to me there's a real dearth of basic scientific and statistical or mathematical understanding in the population as a whole. And given the complexity of the world, it seems like the liberal arts folks ought to get a better dose of technical education, like the technical folks get at least some dose of liberal arts education. Appreciate comments on that.
Good point.
Sure, that's an excellent point. First, just want to point out that mathematics, statistics, physics, all those fields are liberal arts fields. Engineering is generally not considered a liberal arts field, but but the science and the math and the statistics are all taught in liberal arts colleges. Secondly, the caller has an excellent point, which is that when we think about liberal arts education or general education, we do tend to think in terms of literature and philosophy and texts like that. But really, I think I completely agree with the caller that what students need today is understanding of science and understanding of statistics so that they can make sense of science and reporting on science. This is actually the hardest part of instituting any general education curriculum, is to find courses that can teach non-scientists about science without scaring them off. It's hard to find students who get students unscared about that and to get them to really learn something about science and particularly about the mathematical side of it. It's also hard to get faculty to teach it because faculty who teach in those fields generally are not trained to teach non-specialists very well. So it's a real challenge finding enough courses and finding faculty to do it. But I completely agree that it's one of the most important tasks that universities have.
Because people who are trained in those fields would prefer to teach people who are going to major in those areas, or what?
If you ask a scientist to teach a course to students who are non-scientists, what they'll usually say is that if they can't do the mathematics, they're really not going to get the science. In other words, they can teach general concepts and they can teach them a little bit about laboratory work and so forth, but they really can't do serious science unless they have the math. And usually students who have kind of an allergy to science have an allergy to science because of the math part. So that's a difficult thing. It's sort of like making everybody take a course in French without teaching them French. So that's where the difficulty tends to lie. But it's a challenge that universities need to meet because that's one thing that every student needs to know something about these days.
I was dumbfounded when I read, Louis, about how long it takes to get a PhD in certain areas. I mean, longer than it takes a medical degree in some cases, like a PhD in English. Why is that?
There's lots of reasons for that. So the statistic that you're referring to is that currently the median time to get a PhD in English is 9 years, meaning that half of everybody who gets a PhD takes longer than 9 years to get the degree. There are several reasons for that. The main one is the job market. So as everybody knows, I think, at this point, the job market is very poor for people with PhDs in a lot of fields like English and history, and it has been for quite a while. So students tend to stay in school. Often when you're a graduate student, you can teach. You get paid to teach, not a lot of money, but you can teach in the place where you're getting your degree, and you can sort of stick around and kind of get by until a job opens up, and then you can leave and get your PhD. But there are other reasons, too. I think some of it has to do with a kind of paradigm loss. That is, students aren't quite sure what to write their dissertations about in some fields. I know it's true in my field, which is English. It's not quite clear what the research program is, so they have trouble finding a dissertation topic. They have trouble focusing on their research. So there are a lot of different factors involved. But if you compare the situation today of 9-year medium time to back in the 60s and early 70s when it was 6 years, you see there's been an enormous growth. This has caused a lot of concern by people who work in higher education and foundations and so forth with trying to figure out ways to speed up the process of schooling. Because one thing that it does is it discourages people from entering graduate school, because if you're looking at a process that, let's say you're a smart college student and you have an option to go to law school or to get a graduate degree in history. If you're looking at a graduate degree in history taking 8, 9, 10 years and a law degree taking 3 years, you're not going to think too long about your options. And that's bad for us, that is, those of us who teach in universities, because we want smart students to come into our fields and to oxygenate them and to get excited about them. We don't want to discourage them by making it seem like an endless ordeal just to get the degree, let alone try to get a job.
How long should it take, do you think?
Well, I think it should take 4 years, but nobody agrees with me. I mean, I think it should be like law school. It should be a, you know, focused of 3 years of concentrated coursework with not a lot of teaching, which is what a lot of students do, which is what one of the reasons it takes so long. And then there should be a year of research. I think if students just wrote one publishable article and published it in a scholarly journal, it would probably be better than most of the dissertations that get written, because those don't have to be published and they're not peer-reviewed. But that's not a popular view, believe me, especially from among people who spent 6 or 8 years getting their PhD. They don't want to look at a process that might dilute that. But I just think that if you think about what people in my field, English, end up doing, we teach Shakespeare to college students. I don't think it should take 9 years to learn how to do that. It's just we're being way overtrained to do the kind of work that most of us do. Now, it's true in some fields there's a lot of, you have to learn languages, you do archival work. You know, it's very specialized work, and if you're lucky enough to get a job in a research institution, that training will really pay off. But overall, most people don't get those jobs and don't pursue that kind of work, but it still takes everybody that long to get the PhD. It's a real problem, and it's something that makes everybody a little nervous and irritable, but it's something that's probably going to be addressed in the next 5 or 10 years because we're starving people out of our own business. We're not encouraging them to get into it because we're raising the barrier to entry way too high.
Louis Menand is our guest this hour, author of the just released The Marketplace of Ideas, Reform and Resistance in the American University, in which he attempts to answer 4 questions about American higher education today. We have yet to get to one of the questions that, of course, will prompt a lot of phone calls. Why do professors all tend to have the same politics? We'll talk about that in just a moment and welcome more of your phone calls. We thank you for your call, Gary. Our number for on-air participation is 800-486-8655. We do want to take just a few moments to remind you that we are in our Wisconsin Public Radio Winter Membership Drive. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Rhonda Fanning, producer of the program, is here with me now, and we're asking you to invest 3 minutes, that's all it is, 3 minutes of your time in your own future. Our goal is to ensure that all of the programs that you value, including this one, you talk about getting a general education, ooh, you can get it here at the end of the week. Amazing what it is you will know, and a lot of the information will be important to you, if not just information for information's sake. A contribution of any amount will help us, when we ask you to make your gift right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi, Kathleen. And how often do you get to choose the amount of your tuition? But here at Wisconsin Public Radio, you
right.
have that opportunity. Our goal this hour is 75 pledges in the next 25 minutes or so. And the success of this drive depends on you. Thanks to all those who have already given. But if not, give now online at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You decide the amount of your pledge. When you give $150, ask for The Marketplace of Ideas by Louis Menand, our guest this hour. WPR will pass on what we would normally spend on a book or a CD to a Wisconsin food bank in your area, and that's a pretty great thing. So pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Wisconsin Public Radio keeps you informed and entertained 7 days a week. You get value from this program, and also programs like Larry Mueller, Zorba Pastor on Your Health, Care Talk, or Car Talk, and many others you've come to rely on.
WPR gives you a window on the world like no other. Think of all we talk about during the course of actually just a few days. It is phenomenal. Support the exciting mix of programs that you enjoy on this station with your contributions. You can go online at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And not many people know this, but listener contributions make up more than a third of our budget. A third, that is a lot. The number of listeners who contribute to WPR is growing, and that's key to our strength. So we're asking you to jump on that bandwagon today.
And when you may be one of those people who hit your WPR preset every time a commercial comes on your other radio station, that's a sign that it's time to donate. It means that WPR is your main, your number one radio station, and that you're glad that we're listener supported. So please call with your pledge.
That's right. Anytime if you get in your car and turn it on and Wisconsin Public Radio pops on when you turn
yep.
on your car, or maybe your alarm goes off in the morning and WPR is the first thing you hear, that means that you come to rely on this station. So we are coming to rely on you now, asking to you for you to pledge your support. Again, we have that goal of 75 pledges this hour in the next half an hour, so 24 minutes. So please go online now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Thanks, Kathleen.
Thank you so much, Rhonda. Just a reminder, with your pledge of $150, ask for what we're talking about this hour, The Marketplace of Ideas by Louis Menand, WPR.org, or 888-202-2552 is the number to pledge. We're going to on-air calls now, continue them, and we go next to Spencer from Oshkosh. Hi, Spencer.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hey, I want to thank you for this program, first of all. This is very interesting.
You're welcome.
All right. I got a question for your guest, though. I have a question about the practicality of these types of things. And this is coming from someone who loves learning for the sake of learning and knowledge for the sake of knowledge. But I simply, in this economy, could not afford to go to a four-year degree program or to study liberal arts. I chose to go into nursing, which is a degree I got in 2 years, and immediately had a marketable skill and a job, whereas I've seen so many of my friends go to these four-year liberal arts degrees, and they don't know what they want to do, and they end up working at the mall or doing something beneath what they should be. And I just wonder where your guest sees the future of these degrees and our economy.
That's a really good question. I think that probably what we're going to see are more mixed types of higher education institutions where there's a combination of liberal arts programs and professional training programs. So there's a lot of institutions like that all over the country. In fact, I would say more than half of institutions of higher education in the U.S. are of that type. And I think that that kind of combination will probably serve people fairly well. I think that what we inherited from the 19th century is this kind of strict segregation between liberal arts learning for its own sake and practical learning or vocational professional training, and that we're seeing that break down, but we're still sort of the heirs of that old dispensation.
Thanks very much for the call. Bill from Middleton. Hi, Bill.
Hi. this is, I think, on topic and maybe a little off topic. My wife's addicted to the teaching company, and I'm getting there. And the reason I bring it up is I have never heard such good lecture series as I have on the teaching company. And it seems to me a lot of my son is in college now, and there's a whole issue of being able to get into this class and get into that class. In terms of hybrid education, if you could incorporate something like the teaching company so that people could take the courses and take tests and get credit for it, I think it would be a real threat to a lot of universities because I think there's a lot of redundancy when you hear some of these courses. And what I had in University of Michigan, these courses are excellent and I think would replace a lot of things like history and music appreciation. And I'm just wondering, is this something you could see as providing courses for people that can't fit them in, people who I think it would reduce the cost of college education? I know that's kind of heretical, but do you see any way of incorporating such a wonderful tool such as the teaching company?
Is this an online learning thing?
No, it's I'm kind of surprised you haven't heard of it. There's a lot of Harvard people right now. We're listening to a medieval history, and there's a Harvard professor. Excellent, excellent, excellent. No, it's CDs.
Okay, let's get a response.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I didn't know about it specifically, but obviously there are these kinds of programs, and there is also online learning. The new technology is likely to change the way that we teach people. Just even within the classroom itself, in a traditional classroom setting, most students are online, and they are able to basically look up information as you're lecturing them about it, if they're not doing email or something they're not supposed to be doing. And that really changes the way in which we disseminate knowledge, because the usual structure is that I'll talk for 50 minutes and it's just a monologue. But students are more accustomed to getting information multiply in different streams and short bursts and in different forms. So that's one challenge that's presented. It's just pedagogical. But the caller makes another point, which is that there are other ways of disseminating knowledge to people that technology has made possible, and that can be a cheaper way to educate people than having them pay a lot of money to come live somewhere for 4 years, that can rope in a much bigger audience for what higher education has to offer, and that does involve a kind of different business model from the traditional system. So those are all things, I'm not an expert on them, obviously, but those are all things that I think universities are going to have to adapt to in the future. There's a big movement, which is called open access, which I do know something about, which is having faculty make their syllabuses and their lectures and their publications available online to anybody who goes on to the university's website. And that is another way of opening the walls of the university so that they become less of an ivory tower and less of an elite institution than traditionally was the case. But this is does involve a different mindset, a different mentality about what higher education means, about what we're doing, and about how we're doing it.
Let's go back to this, because I'm wondering if you've changed your style at all or added some of those multiple information streams to what you do. You talk about the lecture. You got 50 minutes, you got an hour, you're speaking for that long a period of time. Most of us can remember college that way.
Yeah.
And then you meet in a smaller group to talk about what people like you said.
Right.
How are your students responding to that? Is that a hard thing for you to do? Do you have to sort of switch because we're taking in information from so many sources that you're using a different model?
Yeah, you know, when I went to college, you know, I went to class and the lecturer was really good. You would sit there for 50 minutes spellbound by this talking head,
right,
and then
right.
After 50 minutes there'd be this wonderful sort of intellectual climax, and you'd just walk out very excited about what you were doing. So, of course, I thought, I want to do that, you know, so I became a professor. And I still sort of old-fashionedly think that's the model, is that you spellbind them by your narrative, and they just become fascinated in what you're saying. But I found that students want PowerPoint, you know, and I understand why, because it's a whole lot easier to take in information if they're reading it off a screen as you're talking about it. But it's something that I'm just old enough to have been trained in a completely different form. But that's something that, you know, that I use now because everybody uses it, and it actually organizes the class in ways probably better than used to be the case. But that's just the tip of the iceberg. There's all the research techniques that are available now online. There's the whole problem of online sourcing, which nobody really has figured out how to deal with, you know, how you check facts that you get from Wikipedia or other online sources. There's a tendency of students to rely on all that. So when I was trained, when I was a graduate student, you know, every day I would go to the library with my little backpack and my little pickaxe, and I would go down into the stacks and I would chop facts out of these old, you know, books. And then I would come back and I would know a little bit more than the average person about the subjects that I was learning about, because that information was only available to people with their little pickaxes. Now, you just go on Wikipedia and every piece of trivia that I spent years digging out of the mineshaft is on the screen in a second. So what we're really giving students, what the value added of what we're doing in the classroom, is no longer just information, because information is now pretty much instantaneously available at almost any level of remoteness and esoterica. So we're giving them something else, and that something else is putting the information in motion in a way that turns it into knowledge, giving it a context, giving it a narrative, giving it some kind of coherence. But it's no longer just getting the facts before the students.
Louis Menand is our guest this hour. His book is The Marketplace of Ideas, Reform and Resistance in the American University. He's also the author of The Metaphysical Club, which won the 2002 Pulitzer Prize in History. We're welcoming phone calls for him, 800-486-8655, our on-air line. And just a reminder that we are in our winter pledge drive right now. If you ask for a copy of his book and pledge at $150, that would be just dandy, because this is the hour that will happen. happen. Louis Menand, the marketplace of ideas, and the pledge number, 888-202-2552, or go to WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. More phone calls now. Let's go to Dave from Madison. Hi, Dave.
Oh, hi there, Kathleen. Thanks, as always, for another wonderful show, and to Rhonda as well for her fine work. Professor Menand, thoroughly enjoyed Metaphysical Club.
Thank you.
A really well done piece of writing.
Thank you.
And my question is about the state of the Academy, the American Academy, the future of the Academy, especially as it relates to tenure in the system, and your thoughts on that, please.
Tenure has always been a political football in American higher education, and it's an odd part of the academic system because very few jobs, I guess judgeships are one of the exceptions, have such an institution as tenure. The reason that higher education has tenure, and I think the reason that it's worth preserving, although there obviously is a downside to it as well, is because it's a way of protecting academic freedom. If you allowed departments are self-governing, that is disciplined. So the English department decides who gets to be an English professor. Like, you can't impose it. An appointment on an English department or a sociology department or a physics department. And if departments are self-regulating and they can also lay off people as they choose, then it's going to be difficult for people to pursue their particular scholarly lines of inquiry because they'll always be afraid that if it's out of fashion or somehow objectionable that they'll get fired. So tenure is a way of ensuring academic freedom. Academic freedom is what makes the whole system work because it's what allows people to pursue knowledge wherever it may lead, not to worry about whether some groups find it offensive or some people even don't understand it. And it's a very valuable thing. The downside, of course, is that you tend to get a tendency of people to slack off that some people complain about. I've actually never seen it in my career, but I suppose it can happen. You do get people who are pursuing outmoded lines of research. In public institutions, people won't retire, and therefore they tend to clog up a line, a particular area. So there are all kinds of costs associated with tenure, but I would be very sorry to see it go away.
Thanks very much, Dave, for the call. We need to get to this question. Why do professors all tend to have the same politics?
Yeah, it's a fascinating thing. So there was a survey done about 3 years ago by a couple sociologists named Neil Gross and Solon Simmons, and they did a national survey of the political and social views of the professoriate. And they have it's a pretty good statistically reliable picture, snapshot of the whole of American higher education. And what they found is that 62% of the professoriate identifies themselves as a liberal and less than 20% as some kind of a conservative. They also found that in certain departments, like history, for example, 80% of professors are Democrats and only 3.8% are Republicans. They found at elite colleges and universities in the 2004 election, 95% of social science professors voted for Kerry. The rest voted for three-party candidates, and 0% statistically voted for Bush. So this skewing doesn't suggest that, according to this survey, that professors are radical. It suggests that professors are liberal Democrats. They're Kerry voters. They're Barack Obama voters. But the interesting piece of that is that there are very few professors who think differently, either farther to the left or anywhere to the right. And this skewing, which has always been a little bit the case in higher education because liberalism tends to be associated with higher levels of education generally, it seems to have increased in the last 30 or 40 years. So it's an interesting question why this is so, and there are lots of different theories about it. One theory is that if you're a liberal intellectual, there's kind of no place to park yourself except in a university, whereas if you're a conservative intellectual, particularly in the last administration, you could go to Washington or get jobs at foundations and so forth. That's possible. It's possible that college students who tend to have conservative views value making money or value having a family more than liberal college students do, so they're less likely to go into a career as a professor. And it's also, I think, partly the case that because the obstacles are so high to entry into the academic profession because the time in graduate school is so long and because the job market is so difficult to get to become a professor that people self-select. So they look around and they say, my professors are liberal, I'm not liberal, therefore I'm not going to try to do this because it's just going to be fighting against the current the whole way through until I get a tenured job. So it may be that there's some conformity that's going on out there at the stages of professional reproduction that produces this increasingly homogenous political viewpoint of the professoriate. In any case, I think it's a bad thing. I mean, I'm a liberal Democrat, so why should I complain? But we need diversity. We need ideological diversity as well as all other kinds of diversity in our educational system. And if for some reason the system's not helping us do that, then we ought to think about ways of reforming it.
Hmm. Louis, thank you so much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure, and thanks to your callers. And can I encourage your listeners to pledge?
Please.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Louis Menand. The book is The Marketplace of Ideas, Reform and Resistance in the American University. He's also of the Metaphysical Club, which won the Pulitzer in 2002 for history. Some of you, I'm sure, have read that. For those of you who ask for and can pledge $150, we're happy to send you a copy of The Marketplace of Ideas, Reform and Resistance in the American University, in which he asks some very profound questions and also looks at what's happened in the American university system, how it got set up the way that it was set up, and it actually goes back many, 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 many years ago, and it's worth preserving some of the history and changing things in other significant ways. So it's a good book. Well, we are in our winter membership drive. This is our drive that's taking place right now, and more than ever, you rely on Wisconsin Public Radio and the Ideas Network to talk about current issues and to get that general, which you don't get anywhere else. You get loud opinion in a lot of places, but we give you this general education of a superb quality that we've been talking about this hour. We rely on the money that you give to keep that talk on the air. So your gift today of $60 or $120 or $150 or any amount will keep this important forum for discussion on the air. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Hello again, Rhonda.
Hi, Kathleen. Please give online at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And if we could get 30 more pledges in the next 6 minutes or say, or you can pledge through the news, we can meet this goal. Thank you if you've already given. But if you want to be one of those 30 that haven't yet and can, please go online at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 and help us make that goal.
And you decide the amount of your pledge. Some of you will be able to be extraordinarily generous, and we thank you. Whatever you can give, we appreciate every single dollar you give us. When you give $150, ask for The Marketplace of Ideas by Louis Menand, and you can pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You've been enjoying the conversation with Louis Menand about The Marketplace of Ideas, and his former book, The Metaphysical Club, in 2001, received the Pulitzer. And just out of curiosity, I went into our wonderful archives, and you can search them, and I just limited it to the last year and put in the word Pulitzer, and it came up with 30 results. Just the kind of experts, you know, we get people in the
Isn't
top of their
something?
Field,
right.
People from all walks of life. The other day when we did our show on Motown, someone called in and was like, how cool is this? I'm speaking to one of the original members of the Funk Brothers. It's pretty cool what we do here.
Yeah.
So please go online at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And that even gave us a chance to dance, Rhonda, which was good.
You were dancing. I was sitting.
I
was tapping my foot, I think.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
You just couldn't
yeah.
see it.
All right. Giving at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 is very easy. It just takes a gift of a dollar or two a week and a few minutes of your time.
It's one source where you can get in-depth reports. You can get information about things you didn't even know you wanted to know about. It's real people talking about real things. They talk about musicians in Iraq, you know, rock and roll in Iraq, or in Pakistan or in India. There's no other source like this. What we have here is so wonderful, and I don't think a lot of people realize it. I'm John Ink from Wausau, Wisconsin, and I listen to Wisconsin Public Radio, and it is my source for a clear view of the world.
I'm Kathleen Dunn, back with Rhonda Fanning, here to ask for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio, WPR.org, or 888-202-2552 is where you do that. Make your pledge. Maybe it's $50, $100, $500. Whatever amount you choose is the right amount. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We still need to hear from about 30 people in the next 5 minutes or so. Thanks if you've already given. If not, help us stay on track by making your contribution now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And at that $150 level, ask for the book, The Marketplace of Ideas by Louis Menand. Pledge now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You'll have great conversations as a result of reading the book, too. We had a terrific conversation with Louis, who's a great guest. He offers all the ideas we talked about, and you'll be able to have great conversations if you read what really are a series of four essays. Most of us, regardless of what we do, like to have our work noticed and appreciated. It's true for this program and for Wisconsin Public Radio, and we have a very public way of doing that. That's asking you to pledge your support to Wisconsin Public Radio right now.
The ideas are endless on the Ideas Network.
Yes, they are.
Here on our 20th anniversary. But your pledge, in effect, says, I want more, because you do want more. So give now, securely online at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
And the average pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio, $120. If you can afford it, consider a gift of $1,000. People have done that. That would be about $83 a month, or any amount right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Thank you, everybody. Rhonda, thanks for all of the work that you do.
Thank you, Kathleen.
And thanks to Rhonda for all of her production work. Thanks to Chrissy Peace for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks to John Treader for being with us. And John Treader, John Munson, too. John Treader's with us some days. John Munson for coming down from Superior. And thanks for listening.